Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the A Chicken in Every Pox show. We will explain. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio. And with us from the University of Kentucky Physician Assistant Program, Assistant Professor Shelley Irving. Hi, Shelley.
Hello.
And also from UK, the Interim Executive Director of Networking and Infrastructure, to explain to you how to access us on the wild world of web, Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. You know, you can get the audio of the show, WMKY.org. Moorhead State Public Radio, yes, they have a website. Yes, Health Matters has a page on there. And yes, we do keep some of the shows and some of the links to the audio. If you missed the show, want to hear the show again, want to send the show to a friend, whatever, this is where you would go, WMKY.org. Again, you can download them, listen to them, read about them a little bit. If you really want to interact with them, though, jump over to Facebook.com/HM Radio Show, and there you'll find a fan page devoted exclusively to Health Matters. This gives you the opportunity to see if there may be some content that comes out in the show that we decide to post there. There may be some interesting news that comes out. There could be all kinds of things that get posted on that site, but then also you can post. You can provide feedback. You can give us some show topics. It's, again, your way to interact with Health Matters. Again, found right at Facebook.com/HM Radio Show.
Our sponsor, your top five sources of salt.
Why not
For
six?
Some reason, sources of salt really got me.
Why not seven?
I can give you seven. If you want seven, I've got actually...
You probably got like 13 or 14 or 18.
10. I have 10.
Because you always do these odd numbers. You never do 5, 10, 15, 20. You always do like wild numbers.
Zerlene Quater. That is a great name. Her first name is Zerlene, Z-E-R-L-E-E-N, from the CDC, looked at salt consumption among Americans. And overall, in 2013 and through 2014, Americans consumed about 3,400 milligrams of salt daily. Basically, the American Heart Association says ideal is 1,500. Over twice.
Way above.
Yeah, well, we should. If you want to know where you get your salt. Now, Rick, you could know. I mean, let's face it. You think, where do we get salt? Well, it should be potato chips and pretzels and so forth. Turns out, not even in the top five. Not even in the top five. Potato chips, number seven.
But it's also probably not what we put on our food either, right?
No.
So it's not, you know, self-induced or whatever you're going to call it, self-poured.
You're right.
It's in the processed foods that we buy.
From another source, not from Zerlene, and I feel comfortable enough to call Dr. Quater Zerlene now.
You're on a first-name basis, are you?
Well, because it's such a great first name. Why did I not name my kid Zerlene? I don't know. At any rate—
Because you didn't want— Never mind.
Okay. But from another source, I understood that around 80% of our salt intake comes from processed foods. These are the foods, either they are processed meats, things like the luncheon meats that we get and so forth, or the dinners and the prepackaged things. They put salt in them because salt makes them taste better. But here's your top five. Number one, bread. Number one, more salt in bread than anything else you eat. And they specifically mentioned yeast breads. This is especially as we get older. Turned out it was, and I believe this is a percentile, it was 5.5% of the salt intake in people ages 20 to 50. Time you got up over 70, 8.1%. So breads. Pizza is number two. Apparently we eat a lot of pizza, and pizza has a lot of salt. Number three.
And a lot of bread.
Yeah, true. Mm-hmm. And then sandwiches. And the reason sandwiches are so bad is number four is cold cuts and cured meats. Basically, we've talked about this. If your meat comes in a geometric shape, one, it's going to have quite a bit of fat in it. And two, they salt it. That's how they make it so tasty. And then number five is soup. And soups can be very, very salty. So bread, pizza, sandwiches, cold cuts and cured meats, and soup are your top five sources, food sources of salt. And you can, when you look at those pre-made foods, again, all of those, whether it is commercial bread, whether it's pizza, sandwiches, cold cuts, or soup, all those things come prepackaged for you and pre-salted for you. Your intake, daily intake, 1,500 milligrams a day. Some of these things will be 500 milligrams or more in one serving of one entree, one sandwich or so forth. That is our sponsor, your top five sources of salt. And we believe that you can have a healthier diet with lower salt. Interestingly enough, that is not certain. There are two groups of scientists right now. One group thinks that salt may be the most important aspect of your diet, maybe even more important than cholesterol and fats. Another group says, yeah, we don't know. If you have heart trouble or high blood pressure, limit your salt. But for the rest of us, we're not sure how important it is. And they each have can cite studies to support their point. And I,
what do you think?
Well,
because this is what you're paid for, is to give us your opinion.
Yeah, I think you need to limit your salt. I used to frost my watermelon and my corn. It was, I mean, I would salt it as about as heavy as you could put salt on it. It would crunch with salt. And there's nothing like salty watermelon. It's great. The thing is,
but isn't salty watermelon worse than chocolate on an ice cream? I mean, come on.
I think it is.
It's degrees of dessert, right?
Yeah,
I mean, it seems
yeah,
to me like the watermelon dessert's going to be better than the drizzled ice cream.
Oh, I made that watermelon bad. If over one third of adults are going to wind up having high blood pressure.
That explains a lot about you.
Yeah, yeah. I drank. You know, you talk about drinking the Kool-Aid. I ate the watermelon. But if you look at over one third of us are going to get high blood pressure, at that point we're going to have to limit our salt. It just doesn't make sense to get used to high levels of salt, even if it doesn't cause the diseases later on. You are likely to get some conditions that you need to do it. And if your feet never swell, if you don't have problems with your blood pressure, and you are certain that you will never have problems with your heart, salt away. But I do not believe there are many people who fit in that category.
Isn't it similar to the kind of, and not to use smoking as a in a good way, but I mean, there are people who smoke all their lives, and they smoke and live until 90, and somehow or another manage to avoid lung cancer. Meanwhile, some people smoke for, you know, 10 years, 15 years, and come down with lung cancer. I mean, isn't it? So it's kind of the same thing. It's kind of just your body's kind of, some people are just given a
the
ability to deal with it.
The smoking, there may be a technique where you don't get as much in, or they're certainly, I mean, some people, I believe, do and have an innate resistance, so you're right. Salt, you're pretty much going to get that salt. There's no way you can reject it. You can't puff lightly.
But some people don't, they just deal with it. Their body deals with it chemically different.
And they are at lower underlying risk of heart disease.
Right.
And so that they don't have to worry about it as much. So there is, again, a controversy, but we are recommended, I am recommended, that you limit your salt
intake. You put salt on your baked potato?
No. I don't put salt on anything anymore. My wife is not a potato person, and so, as you know, I mean, she buys the groceries,
so essentially,
takes care of things.
Yeah,
do not eat baked potatoes very often at all.
Because if something happens to Francis, you're going to have a rough time eating. You and the delivery boy are going to get to know each other.
Let's move on. I don't need this. I really don't need this. And plus, we get to talk about Shelley. That's even more fun than talking about me.
No, it's not.
Yeah, sure it is.
No, we've made a living out of talking about you.
It's more fun to me anyway.
To who?
Shelley, first of all, some things you need to know. About 1 million cases of shingles diagnosed in the U.S. every year. Half of those are in people ages 60 or older. Now, shingles, again, there is a virus called chickenpox, and most of us our age have had it. Younger generation, they may be doing the vaccine and preventing chickenpox, but we had it. And Shelley, you and I talked. I was purposely, my loving, kind, concerned parents took me in the presence of another person who had chickenpox. It is highly contagious. It is airborne. And they let me play in the room with that person when I was young to make sure that I got the chickenpox, because that's what a good parent would do.
Pox parties. Yeah, I attended one of those too.
Yeah, Rick?
At least one.
I don't know.
You don't remember.
I was too young. I was a little bitty thing.
So you didn't think, my parents are trying to off me.
I mean, I can't really remember if I was 4, 5, 6, 7. I'm pretty sure I wasn't 8 or 9. But I was pretty young. And I know I had them. I just don't know when. And I've got a few scars from where I picked them. So I wasn't a baby.
Right.
Now, that's the one thing they say is, you know, you let your baby get it so they can't give themselves any scars.
That's weird. At any rate.
I've heard people say that. I mean, I've heard people say that, you know, because they can't pick. They can't pick at them, right? What's the old thing? If you keep picking at one of the chicken pox, it'll turn into a scar. That's what people always told me when I was younger.
That's just sad. So misinformed. Back to our story. It's not about Rick. It's not about me.
It is
actually about Shelley. And
we
Shelley,
got four
like
minutes
all of
to
us,
kill. It can be about whatever we want.
Had the chicken pox. And the chicken pox, it does, the rash clears. You are no longer infectious. But the virus itself hides in the nerve roots in your spine. And it does that for everyone who has had chickenpox, but not for those young kids now who are getting the vaccine. Shelley had it in the nerve roots in her spine. And Shelley, pick up the story from there. What exactly happened?
Well, and then I developed shingles. So I currently do have shingles.
And shingles, again, it looks like chickenpox, except it is in one nerve root. It is in one, the nerves, they cover a patch of skin. These are sensory nerves, and they take care of the sensation from a patch of skin. So Shelly has a patch of skin that has blisters and red spots.
Yes, that is correct.
And what did you notice first?
Well, I noticed some itching, and there wasn't a rash, probably a day or two before the rash showed up. Then, you know, red, like a papular, just raised red rash appeared. And then about 36 hours later, it started itching and burning a little bit and then spread to my back and, from my side.
And I will tell you, the thing among physicians is usually it's the second guy that gets to diagnose shingles. The first guy, somebody comes in with itching or irritation and there's not much there. And then the patient goes to a different doctor because the first guy didn't know what he was doing or she was doing. And they get diagnosed the second time because by then the typical rash has appeared. So you had those symptoms, the itching, the burning, and then the rash came up.
Yes, that is correct.
Yeah. And you are now how far into it?
The rash appeared on Sunday, so.
We're recording on Wednesday.
On Wednesday, so
about
so
3 days.
Yeah.
And when those blisters first appear, when they open up, once again, this is a virus that is highly contagious, airborne. Fortunately, again, 99% of the population has it at our age or has had the vaccination. But there are a few people that didn't get it and didn't have a vaccination. And so especially as a healthcare provider, we have to be very cautious if we wind up with shingles. Now, it is said that shingles happens when your immune system is no longer able to control the virus, either due to poor nutrition or perhaps a new medication or stress or something like that. Why did your immune system let you down, Shelly? What do you think's wrong with your immune system?
It doesn't like me. I'm certainly not old enough for the shingles.
No, she is rather young, and I will say the majority, almost every patient that I've had with shingles, we have no idea why shingles happen. It just happens. And the idea that it is some harbinger of some serious illness, that may be in a referral clinic. Again, if you run a transplant clinic, you're going to see a lot of shingles when you start anti-rejection drugs and things like that. But for my practice, the majority of my patients, absolutely nothing wrong. Out of the blue, they develop shingles, and that sounds like what you've got. The most feared complication, postherpetic neuralgia, that is perhaps the reemergence of this from the nerve root, could cause damage to this nerve and cause it to send abnormal signals. How's that going?
Fine. I'm really having as far as symptoms of my old case, I don't have a lot of pain. It's not distracting. The itching is worse than the stinging at this point.
There is a vaccine. And keep in mind, you've been exposed, in order to get shingles, you've been exposed to the chickenpox virus. But still, if we boost your immunity with a vaccine, it's recommended at age 60, it drops your risk of shingles by 50%, your risk of nerve damage by two-thirds. It is a good thing to do. Rather expensive, but a good thing to do. Another good thing to do is to take a break. We're going to do that and come back with our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the A Chicken in Every Pox show. We are making fun of Shelley because she has shingles. I'm going to let her respond because she did do...
she took one for the team.
Yeah, she did. And she also has done a little bit of research work. We'd like to talk a little bit about that. Just a reminder again, I think the main point I want to get across, there is a vaccine. This vaccine is recommended at age 60. A one-time shot, because again, we're doing the population numbers. Shelley is not going to rush out and get the vaccine because she developed a case of shingles. It turns out if you have a case of shingles, that neither raises nor lowers your risk of another case of shingles in the future. But this vaccine can drop your risk of recurrence by 50%, your risk of developing nerve damage by two-thirds. It's a good thing to do. It's expensive, but it is recommended at age 60. And that's all I'll say, and I'll let her talk. Before we do, one more time through our sponsor, your top five sources of salt, just reminding you that salt, the top five sources here of salt from the CDC, from Dr. Zerline Quater, at the CDC, an analyst down at the CDC says, number one is bread, two is pizza, three is sandwiches, four is cold cuts and cured meats, five is soup. Now, if we go further, we will also see 6 is burritos and tacos. Bad news there. Savory snacks, and that's 7. And that is going to be potato chips, pretzels, and things like that. Number 8 is chicken, and I think especially fried chicken. 9, cheese has quite a bit of salt. And 10 is eggs and omelets, to let you know the foods that have a lot of salt. Now, these are individual foods. If you look at, again, a TV dinner or things like that, and certainly we mentioned soups, these have these types of things that come ready to eat or ready to microwave. If they don't put a lot of sugar in them, they put a lot of salt in them. We've said before, salt, there are some people who feel that salt is the most evil thing you can do to your diet. There are others that feel that salt is now overblown as a source of disease and death, and these two groups are duking it out. Right now, the American Heart Association has really come down hard on salt and saying that you should not eat more than 1,500 milligrams a day. Means that if you're picking up a can of soup or you're picking up a dinner and you're seeing 400 to 500 milligrams in that one thing, you're going to have trouble staying under 1,500 milligrams. And the average right now in the U.S. is around 3,500 milligrams or so. We are not anywhere near the American Heart Association recommendations. That's our sponsor, your top 5 sources of salt. So, Shelley, what do you know about shingles?
Well, you mentioned that for people 60 years and older, that it's recommended that they get the vaccine one time. According to the CDC, though, the vaccine only lasts for about 5 years. So I thought that was pretty interesting. You can still get shingles after you've had the vaccine. If you have already had shingles, you can still get the vaccine, and it will, we think, provide some protection against getting it again.
The idea, I think, is just to show your immune system, just a reminder, a refresher course in what that virus looks like, and allow your immune system to make the proteins. It is odd, though, that the shingles itself doesn't have any protective at all. What you've done is, like I said, it neither increases nor decreases your risk of having another event.
Right. And you can get the shingles vaccine whether you remember or know for sure that you had chickenpox as a child. The CDC considers all of those who were born before 1980 in the U.S. anyway to be immune to varicella. So we don't have to have any proof or do a titer, get a blood test to see if you have indeed been exposed to chickenpox previously.
Looking across the room, I see a lot of pre-1980s in our cast.
Pre-pre.
Well, this recommendation from Health Matters, if you're over age 60, look into that shingles vaccine and understand that, you know, it's hard to figure out should you have it every 5 years. Currently, the CDC is not recommending that. We're looking at the titers. We're looking at the risk. And if we can, for a period of time, lower your risk and perhaps have maybe less effect going after 5 years, it still seems to be beneficial. And so we do recommend that. I'm going to read an announcement from the FDA, and also the same problem discussed by the CDC. So here's the FDA announcement first. See if you can kind of get an inkling of what's going on. FDA announcement, Orlando, Florida's Fresh Express is announcing a precautionary recall of a limited number of cases of organic market side spring mix. It is the 5-ounce spring mix marketed in a clear container, distributed only to Walmart stores located in the southeastern region of the United States. The recall was necessitated when Fresh Express was notified that extraneous animal matter was allegedly found in a single container of the salad. Out of an abundance of caution, all salads manufactured in the same production run are being recalled. No other salads are included in the recall. Fresh Express salads are not subject to recall. And there is a toll-free number. That's the FDA announcement. Pretty bland, wouldn't you say? Nothing there. Here's the CDC report on the same thing. Experts from the CDC are working with the Florida Department of Health and the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to support an investigation of a dead bat that was found in a prepackaged salad purchased at a grocery store in Florida. Two people in Florida reported eating some of the salad before the bat was found. The bat was sent to the CDC rabies lab for laboratory testing because bats have been found to have rabies. The deteriorated condition of the bat did not allow for the CDC to definitively rule out whether or not the bat had rabies. So, in fact, this couple was interrupted in their salad by a need for rabies shots.
Ugh.
Now, The incredible thing to me, first of all, well, there are so many incredible things. What would you do if you found a decayed dead bat in your salad mix?
That's why I don't eat salad.
Eating a dead bat, there is no studies at all that indicate that improves your health. Mixing dead bats in your salad, bad idea.
That's also why I don't eat cold food. Everything has to be cooked. It has to live. It has to be able to live in very high temperatures for a period of time.
Man, I feel for this elderly couple that bought this salad mix, put it on the
table. Gotta wonder, how big was it? Baby bat?
Most bats aren't very big.
Yeah, it's, you know, I mean.
Yeah, but I mean, it's bigger than a cherry tomato.
A little bit.
I mean, was it
mouse
size? Was it salad dressing?
Mouse. And this is, at this point, this is all we know. They're getting rabies treatment. Obviously, they've recalled them. Obviously, the FDA was minimizing the drama here. We at Health Matters are under no such limitations. We'll be glad to point out there was a dead bat in the salad.
We have a bit of a dramatic flair.
That's right.
Go with that? I mean, what can you possibly talk about the rest of the segment that'll be better than a decayed dead bat in a bad salad?
Well, you wonder if it had salt.
And I'm adding some bad salad there because I assume.
It's beyond testing for rabies. That's how far gone this bat was. They were not able to test it for rabies virus. And you can test a lot of stuff for rabies virus. Oh, that's the world we live in. Now, here's another alarming. Let's just panic.
Can we get the CDC version and not the not the other version?
Yeah. Yeah.
You want the FDA version? Animal matter. No, dead bat. Dead. I mean, the thing was, it was not like the
aged. Oh. It would be aged.
Yeah. What's that? It's a something. I don't know what
it's
it is.
Aged
no, it's
matter.
A bat. Look at that. That's a bat. I think that's a bat. Ah. European Society of Cardiology News reported out April 11, 2017. Aging is obviously an unavoidable coronary risk factor. And this is Dr. Irini Samuel, who's a cardiologist at Cairo University, Egypt. More research is needed on the skin signs, the cutaneous signs of risk that would help us intervene earlier. And he points out atherosclerosis and graying of the hair have similar mechanisms with impaired DNA repair, oxidative stress, inflammation, hormonal changes, and so forth. This study they did assessed the prevalence of gray hair in people with coronary artery disease and whether it was an independent risk marker. Now, we do have, there is one skin finding, and that is an earlobe crease that has been throughout the years documented as a risk factor, as not necessarily a risk factor, but as a signal, a marker of people at higher risk for coronary artery disease. Now they're looking at gray hair. They did a study. 545 men who underwent a CAT scan, they call it CT coronary angiography. In other words, they had in place of a cardiac catheterization, they had a CT scan with dye to look at their arteries to the heart. And then they divided them into subgroups according to the presence or absence of gray hair. First of all, grade 1 was pure black hair. Keep in mind, this was done in Cairo, Egypt, I assume. Number 2, grade 2, black hair more than white hair. Number 3, black hair equals white hair. Now, Rick is still a pretty solid 2. Black hair more than gray.
Okay.
You're not a number 1 anymore, Rick.
Okay. I don't care.
Well, you should care because we're talking about your risk of heart disease. If you were a number 1.
There are many other things that, that got me worried on the heart disease.
Okay. But
it's the bacon. It's the.
Yeah. Number 4, white more than black. And number 5, pure white hair. And I got to say, I am losing my hair as I get older. And this is.
It's not really that noticeable, though.
Well, thank you for that.
And I've known you for a long time. You've been losing your hair a long time, apparently.
You started off with a compliment, but you just couldn't hold it, could you?
I never intended for it to be a compliment.
Okay, fair enough. Then it just accidentally came out as a compliment.
I had to recover.
You had to write the course there and make sure that it was an insult after all. But I will tell you, I was jealous of these guys with the gray hair because a lot of them have a full head of hair. I do not have a full head of hair anymore. I'm not bald, but I don't have a full head of hair. My kids say, "Dad, we're so pleased that you take this so well." And I thought, well, I don't take this well at all.
You don't have any choice.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to get a hair transplant. But on the other hand, I've got thinning hair. Now, If you have hair whitening, grade 3 or more, and grade 3 was black equals white, that was associated with an increased risk of coronary artery disease, and that was independent of your age and other established risk factors. Now, obviously, you can't dye your hair and lower your risk of heart disease. This is just a thing that happens, but it is apparently a marker. So, according to Dr. Irene Samuel, again, atherosclerosis and hair graying occur through similar biological pathways. The incidence of both increases with age. Our findings suggest, irrespective of your age, hair graying indicates biological age and could be a warning sign of cardiovascular risk. So those wonderful gray-headed people that I admired apparently have signs of accelerated aging in the graying of their hair. Fortunately, I'm just losing mine rather than having those accelerated things.
So what happens to those who lose their hair before it turns gray?
Well, the evidence is mixed. I thought we should, Shelly, exactly, we should talk about this. In the this was back in May 2015 in the Netherlands Heart Journal. There was a group that investigated the association between male pattern baldness and the severity of heart disease. 511 male patients. These people underwent a regular catheterization, and they looked. And in their analysis, in what they call a multivariate analysis, when you accounted for the fact that they would have been older or there were other things, there was not a relationship between being bald and having heart disease. So if we take baldness as the extreme of thinning hair. Now, some other older studies had indicated that baldness was associated, but this group did not find that. And they have one of the better studies to date on that. So of the two, it appears that graying, again, this is one study compared to one study, but it looks like graying may be a little bit more of a risk factor than baldness, which surprised me, to be honest. So fortunately, I don't think I'll have any hair left to turn gray, so I'm safe on the the cardiac disease. Rick, meanwhile, full head of hair. Tinge of gray. I'm watching when he moves up from a 2 to a 3.
I didn't get gray hair until I came on the show.
Well, considering we've been on the air for 13 years now.
Well, I mean, there is that.
Yeah.
If you want to get technical.
Okay. Well, it's too much levity here. We got to get serious.
Uh-oh. What are we talking about? Something like
physician-aided dying in Oregon.
I'm out.
How about that? Yeah, I thought
I'm out.
Sure. Rick's going to go. But here's what we got. April 7th, this was in the journal, the American Medical Association Journal of Oncology, and they looked at the Oregon experience. Oregon was the first state to legalize physician-assisted death. They call it death with dignity. That was 1997, and it's been 20 years. It's now legal in 6 states and also in Washington, D.C. Now, here's the Oregon criteria for physician-aided dying. They must be a resident of Oregon. You can't go there to death tourism, whatever that would be. That's not a you can't do that. You must have a life expectancy of 6 months or less, and we doctors are not very good at estimating this, but we can make guesses. Prescriber must be a physician with an MD or DO license in Oregon. That is no physician extenders, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and so forth. And no one else is allowed to do that. Patients must be capable of making health decisions for themselves and must be able to self-administer the drug. Now, think about that. You are 6 months away from death, but you must be able to take the medicines by yourself. They can't be given to you by someone else. It makes sense that you don't want other people giving you drugs that might cause death. On the other hand, if you are severely ill, you may not be able to self-administer.
So do they have to have a psychiatric evaluation first?
No. The physicians must inform them of alternatives, including comfort care, pain control, and hospice, and they must make 2 oral requests and 1 written request over a minimum period of 15 days. In other words, this can't be a, that's it, I've had enough, I don't want to see you tomorrow morning. This has to be well thought out. I've thought about my options. I've been informed about the alternatives, and over a period of more than 2 weeks, I will make 2 oral requests and 1 written request. So you have to repeatedly say, I want this. Since the law passed 20 years ago, 1,500 and change people have received prescriptions and 991 have died from ingesting the medications. Now, of those, more than 3/4 had cancer. Around 77% did. Lung cancer most common, followed by breast cancer. 51% male, 48% female. I'm a little surprised at that, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And 97% of them were white. They vary by age, 10% younger than age 55, youngest 25 years old, oldest 102 years old. Someone that decided it was time to die at age 102. Median age was 71 years. Nearly all of them were enrolled in hospice, over 90%. All had health insurance. Three-quarters had at least some college education.
So the 500, the discrepancy between who got the medication and who died from ingesting it, did they change their mind or did it not work? Do we know?
No, it was actually, I'll say, very, very effective when they took it. So people had the medicine on reserve. All right, if things don't get better or if things get worse, I'm going to end it. And they had that ability to control their time of leaving, but they, in fact, left naturally rather than taking the medications. So the dose was lethal in nearly all cases. Over 99% of those who actually took the medicines died. And you think, I mean, Shelly, you and I had this conversation. I am flummoxed by I'm personally not in favor of the death penalty, but the idea that the death penalty cannot be enforced due to lack of effective medications. 1,000 Kentuckians every year beg to differ. So drug overdose is something that we see a lot, and it's kind of baffling that people would not be able to do that. In the same way, these medications, secobarbital 1, and we know that you can use narcotic medicines, and you can take yourself out of this world with those pretty reliably. And so that was not the issue. It was, I think, for some people, having the medications available made them feel that they could control their life. But they were, when they were taken, they were extremely effective. They pointed out, Art Kaplan, who's a medical ethicist, says, look, relatively few people use this option. Again, 991 people over 20 years decided to do it. The third that never used them would have killed themselves. It's a point that those who never used it would have killed themselves without it. And so it may have actually saved a few lives. I think that's a weak argument. Mm-hmm. But no one, having the medicines in your back pocket and saying, all right, if this gets any worse, I've got a way out, may have actually allowed people to live, some people to live a little bit longer because they had the medications. I'm not sure about that.
I don't know either.
Well, I am sure that.
Sure about one thing.
It is time to end this fractional portion. We're going to come back with our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the A Chicken in Every Pox show. We are saluting and making fun and ridiculing our medical co-host.
We're ridiculing Tony.
Well, we do that every show. In this particular show, we've decided to add Shelley to the ridicule patch, which means that Rick...
Huh?
Well, I got you on the solar energy last show, but still, I think Shelley and I are going to work on a special ridicule Rick segment for the next show.
My coal is still burning. How's that solar doing for you?
Won't let it go. But this is a chicken and every pox because we've been talking about shingles to celebrate the fact that to bemoan the fact that Shelley Irving did come down with a case of shingles, which happens to 1 in 3, I believe, overall people in the United States at some point. The risk goes up as you get older. There is a vaccine recommended at age 60 that does seem to lower your risk some of that. It drops the risk of getting it in half, drops the risk of developing nerve damage as a result of shingles by 2/3, so a pretty good thing to do, and we do recommend it. Our sponsor for the final time, the top 5 sources of salt in the U.S. diet, and again, the top 5. Number 1, more salt to more people than any other bread. Number 2, pizza. Number 3, sandwiches. Number 4, cold cuts and cured meats. Number 5, soup. Those are your top 5. And we're trying to keep your sodium intake under 1,500 milligrams. By all means, read the label. You will have a section on sodium. It will give a milligram amount. Your total daily intake should be, according to the American Heart Association, under 1,500 milligrams. Now, the average American right now depending on age, is around 3,500. It peaks out actually between age 20 and 50 at 3,700 milligrams of sodium a day. Young adults to middle-aged adults have a pretty hefty salt intake. We're not sure about the 1,500. You know, we've talked about whether or not this is a way to prevent disease, and we think the story is still to be told on that. On the other hand, we are sure about the 3,700. That is a lot of salt. And so if you can get your salt levels down below 3,000, you're at least on the way to meeting the American Heart Association recommendations. And again, realize that if you don't, first thing, you just throw away the salt shaker. You do not need to salt any food in the U.S. Our food is so salty. That is not the issue. And then when you start looking at the package label, if you're seeing something that has 50 milligrams of sodium or in that range, that's not going to contribute a lot. But when you get up to 300, 400, 500 milligrams of sodium per serving, you have a problem. That is our sponsor, the top five sources of salt. I want to talk for a moment about, and Rick, I'm throwing you a bone here. This is from the National Institute of Biomedical Imaging and Bioengineering, so it's right up your alley or down your
lane.
Thank you very
much. Whatever
you
want to say it.
Yeah, and they're talking about wearable biosensors, and we are on the cusp of doing something remarkable with wearable biosensors. This is the amount of newsworthiness that this material is, in my mind, suspect. But I thought it was a good thing for us to bring up. First of all, we know that changes in heart rate, blood pressure, and body temperature can reveal health issues. We monitor these things continuously while people are in a hospital. And obviously, we now have the ability to monitor them regularly out in outside the hospital with Fitbit and other devices. I just mentioned Fitbit because it's commonly used. But Grace Ping, who's the director of the National Institute of Biomedical Imaging and Bioengineering, said you can't really make any scientific conclusions from single personal data. But if you aggregate the data and look at it, you can make some sense. This is a team of researchers from Stanford. First followed one man's results for 2 years. He wore seven different devices for a period of 2 years. A brave man. Just this guy, I guess you'd say, watched up.
But he was a geek.
He geared up. Yeah,
but they don't necessarily mean he wore seven at once. He wore seven over the span of 2 years. I've wore three over the past 2 years.
He looked at his level of activity, his radiation exposure, levels of oxygen in his blood, recorded more than 250,000 measurements every day. So he was geared up. Based on its accuracy and ability to measure three key variables, that's heart rate, skin temperature, and movement, decided to use a device to monitor additional 43 subjects on those for 5 months each. And they had some success. They pointed out one of the initial participant had four periods where his heart rate and skin temperature were unusually high. He reported some symptoms like congestion. Following one of those periods, he was diagnosed with Lyme disease. So they said, gee, before he had any symptoms of Lyme disease, we knew something was up because his heart rate had speeded up and his skin temperature was warmer. Three other participants of their 43 became sick during the monitor period, and in each case, the patient's heart rate spiked compared to their average. Now, again, you can imagine if you're scared, your heart rate's going to go up. If you're climbing the stairs, it's going to go up. If you have a bad day, you're angry, it's going to go up. All those sort of things.
Listening to Health Matters.
It's going to go up, absolutely. until you turn the radio off, and then hopefully it'll go back down. But if you have a period of sustained elevation of your heart rate, it may be an indicator, and these guys are still working on that. I think the point is, and we've all talked about this before, it might be that these devices will be able, by monitoring your vital signs, to detect a pattern that they have not seen before for you and recommend that you get that checked out. Now, I will tell you, if you came to me in my office, in my clinic, and said, my wearable biosensor says that I need to get checked out, I would be absolutely baffled.
Wouldn't you say why?
I have been trained all my life to interpret symptoms. If you are coughing, if you have a pain in your chest, if your ear hurts, if you have a decline in your vision, I have textbooks and seminars, and I've been to classes on what to do about that. If you come in with a change in your biosensors, it is brand new ground for me. I will have to translate it into something. And the first thing I'm going to ask you about is symptoms. You know, well, okay, so your heart rate's up. It's not by itself too fast. I don't need to slow it down. What are your symptoms? What are we looking for here? And I don't have a biosensor profile that says every time you come in, I need to get an X-ray or a urine test or anything like that.
But that's today, Tony. I mean, that's, of course you don't have it because it doesn't exist. But here's the thing. These devices, what do you think is the most important thing about these devices today? In your opinion, what would you say would be the most important thing? Like, do they need to do certain things? They need to be accurate. What do they need to be do?
Yeah, I think whatever they report, I need it to be accurate, and also I need some norms. You know, when do I get alarmed?
So I wanted one answer. You gave me three. So
that's how I score well on the test.
Well, yeah, but if you put three answers on a multiple guess, you're going to miss it. So to me, from a technology standpoint, in a home environment, right? So let's say your wrist is a home environment. And in the hospital, I can afford to spend $50,000 on an analyzer that will give me a high degree of accuracy that I can put a quality control test around, and I can tell when I'm one or two or three standard deviations out, and I can essentially make sure that my machine is calibrated to give me accurate results all the time, right? And I can test for that, and I can't do that at home. There's just no way to do that in a cost-effective manner. So what I need at home isn't accuracy. I need consistency.
Okay.
I need my results. I don't care if my blood pressure is 120 over 80. I don't need it to tell me it's 120 over 80. It can tell me it's 125 over 82. What I need to understand is when it goes from, if it's always 125 over 82, the day it goes to 130 over 90, something's changed.
Right, like your bathroom scale.
Exactly.
Your weight doesn't matter, but your change in weight does.
Right, so it's important that we get the technology consistent, and then we can start gathering the data. Then the data becomes important because we can offset for, you know, various, you know, environments, for various, you know, things that influence the data, right? So we can compensate for that mathematically or, you know, through some type of an algorithm. But clear, the data has to be consistent. It doesn't necessarily have to be accurate. It has to be consistent. And sometimes that's hard to think about, right? Because you think, well, no, it should say if it says my SpO2, which is my pulse oximetry, is 99.8, well, it just needs to be the same. And when it goes down to 80, I know there's a problem.
Yeah, I see your point. And I hadn't thought of the bathroom scale analogy, but I see what you're saying. So accuracy is really not, but
so
consistency
is
important.
The thing is I would say 2 years ago, your Fitbit wasn't always consistent. The detection methods weren't the same. You could go out and you know, the one thing we've figured out is we figured out how to do the GPS, right? We figured out how to do the motion and the accelerometers and that sort of thing. What we haven't done is the things that measure your skin temperature and that. We've got to figure out how to get all that consistent so that the data going in is good. Then you'll start to see the research be able to take that data and make big, massive views of population bases and actually say, okay, now we've got data. It's very difficult, Tony, because your techniques can be slightly different than mine. And it changes the results of the test. And so, you know, it's hard to look at me and you in a test plan and do research on just the way you and I are. But it's easier to look at a larger level, looking at more consistent numbers. You know, you can tell, generally speaking, when people exercise, their heart rate goes up. When their skin temperature goes up and their heart rate goes up, they've got a fever. Or, you know, you can make those broader generalizations.
Now, the reason I brought this is not news. I mean, again, so a guy got diagnosed with Lyme disease, and his heart rate monitor and skin temperature monitor was up before then. Here's why I thought about this.
Because you didn't want me to stay quiet.
No. I have a question for you, if you would stay quiet. But here's my problem. My mother is in her past or mid-80s now. She lives alone on the other side of the state. And I visit her when I can. I also try to call her a couple of times a week just to see that she'll pick up the phone. And then she goes on and she talks about stuff, and we talk about stuff. And
you fake listen.
Yeah, you do. That's what you do for your aging mother. You humor her and so forth. What if I bought her a Fitbit?
Why would you?
So I can make sure her heart is beating.
How old is she?
Without having to call her.
Now, this is a tough answer to your question. Is there a medical ethics question that says, Should you? Do you really need to know that?
I would tell her that I would like for her to wear it so I can keep tabs on her.
So wouldn't the keep tabs on her be, hey, how about if I put a security camera up and watch you?
That's creepy.
Well.
Do you think that heart rate, do you think that I think a heart rate monitor is less invasive than a camera. Do you think that or you don't think that?
No, I mean, obviously a camera is very invasive. I mean, it's Big Brother, but it's actually Sun. I mean, it's different when it's, you know, I mean, so, well, the thing is the one thing that the camera will tell you is it'll first off tell you if there's electricity to the home. Because you can't get it if you're away.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, well,
it'll also tell you if the house is on fire.
Yeah.
It'll tell you, I mean, you know, it'll tell you all the various things that the Fitbit probably can't give you. And really, all you're trying to find out is if your mother's okay.
Right.
But the heart rate, so if the heart rate goes from, so here's the thing. You're looking for a heart rate to go from 70 to, and I'm not saying you're looking for it, but you're monitoring it so to see if it goes to zero.
That's absolutely right. Now, on the other hand.
What if it goes from 70 to 90?
Not a big problem. If it goes to like 150, which is a very high heart rate,
not a problem
then
for
I know
you,
she's dehydrated
doctor,
and sick. Yeah.
Not a problem for you, Mr. Doctor, but if you put that in the hands of somebody who's not a medical professional and they see mom's heart rate go up, now all of a sudden you got to visit to the doctor.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a couple things here. You're trying to make sure your mom's okay. You're not trying to make sure your mom's really healthy.
No. But I could use it. If she's becoming dehydrated, her heart rate is climbing some, that might be beneficial.
You can't tell if she's dehydrated.
No, she was recently hospitalized for dehydration and her heart rate actually wasn't up.
Honestly, I think your better solution is you teach your mom how to use FaceTime. Right? So when you call her and you're fake listening, she can see your face listening, fake listening, and then you can actually see her and she can't fake what you see. Thus, you'll know if she's healthy or not. And you get to talk to your mom. It's great, man.
Yeah, somewhat.
You'll be the son.
Can't I just check her heart rate? I mean, well, we had a situation. I'll tell you, I had a meeting in Lexington, and I realized I was getting out early. And I thought, well, I'll just go ahead and drive because Lexington's an hour in her direction. So I thought I'll just go down there and drive. So I started driving, and I called her, and she had left the phone off the hook. And so I got a busy signal, and so
security camera, you'd have known.
Yeah, well, I would have known that, but I couldn't. The thing about, and you're right, a security camera, obviously I couldn't communicate with her. Maybe I couldn't communicate with her. So I went ahead and drove. I pulled up and stopped for a minute because she had some work done around the house, and I was taking some pictures to email to my brothers. Meanwhile, the neighbor guy saw me stop there and said, uh-oh, something's happening. And so he tried to call her, and her phone's off the hook. So he came over to
so
protect her.
So now you've created panic.
Yeah. Do you see that? And see, if I had had a heart rate monitor, this whole thing could have been avoided.
Or a security camera.
But the phone would still be off the hook.
The phone would be. But he did. He's your next door neighbor. He came over and said, you know your phone's off the hook. Of course, I just told her, you know your phone's off the hook. So she had two reminders about the phone. And,
don't you think it's funny? Don't you think we could come up with a better technology these days that would, you know, instead of the phone being off the hook forever, that we could actually, like, notify somebody and...
Rick, she has in her house either four or five phones. She insists this one has really big numbers, and it's a 1970s vintage phone, so she feels comfortable with it. We have bought her phones.
Does she call you with it?
The buttons are too small. Yeah, she never calls me. I always call her. That's
so
that's
here, now we're getting to the real heart of the problem here. No, I do think, though, Tony, I think, you know, there is some good to put a wearable on them. You know, I think we'll probably need to wrap this up in a minute or two, but there is some good to putting a wearable on them. I think you got to understand why you're putting the wearable on them, though. I think to try to say, you know, to monitor, you know, when they're 85, 90, are you really looking for subtle differences and subtle changes, or are you really just looking to see whether they're there or not?
Yeah.
I know that sounds harsh, but...
No, and she would absolutely agree with that. She does not want any kind of medical interventions at this point. She just wants to be left alone.
But the problem is I think if you put the tool in everybody's hands at this moment in time, they're not really sure how to use it. And that's going to result in what you talked about was the patient coming into you, showing you a problem that you have no tools today to deal with. And now, in 3, 4, 5 years, you're going to have those tools. Because their research is going to be done, and they're going to understand how that data fits into your practice. That's coming. It's just a matter of time.
Fair enough. Give me 30 seconds.
You're the show host.
It's like, you just go ahead and you mess everything up because it's your show. All right, here's what we've got. This from the CDC, reported out April
6th. Is this the light version or the heavy version?
No, this is the full bat version.
The flying version or the nice version?
I have a new adjective here. Among U.S. adults ages 18 to 69 years old, 43% are infected with HPV. Now, most of us will clear that virus, but I want to say again, 43% are infected with HPV. Some of us won't, and the ones that won't, particularly the women, will develop cervical cancer or have a higher risk of cervical cancer. We believe HPV causes over 90% of cervical cancer. Men will develop genital warts and other conditions, again, related to human papillomavirus. There is a vaccine. You can vaccinate your children so that they will the virus will not find a rest in your child. They will be able to fight the virus off. Keep in mind, we talk about this, the idea this was a sexually transmitted disease. In fact, again, 42.5% of U.S. adults have it. That vaccination, the HPV vaccination, is a very good idea. Another very good idea would have been to get off the air about
30 seconds ago. Special thanks to our Morehead State Public Radio producer, Brian Courtney, and to Eric Bilber, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show, and remember,
Health Matters is an injectable prescription radio show that may improve blood sugar in adults with type 2 diabetes mellitus. Is that what it is? And should be used along with diet and exercise.
Health Matters is not recommended as the first choice of medicine for treating diabetes. It is not known if Health Matters can be used in people who have had pancreatitis.
Health Matters is not a substitute for insulin and is not for use in people with type 1 diabetes. It is not known if Health Matters is safe and effective for use in children.
Health Matters may cause serious side effects, including
possible thyroid tumors, including cancer. Tell your healthcare provider if you get a lump or swelling in your neck, hoarseness, trouble swallowing, or shortness of breath. These may be symptoms of thyroid cancer.
That's right. If you're listening to us and you get a lump in your throat, it's probably cancer. In studies with rats and mice, Health Matters and radio shows that work like Health Matters cause thyroid tumors, including thyroid cancer. It's not known if Health Matters will cause thyroid tumors or thyroid cancer, but it probably won't. Whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.